Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Leadership on the Line. I'm Dr. Burton Clark. Today's topic is seatbelts, past, present, and future. The purpose of the show is to continue bringing attention to the fact that about 45% of the fire service does not wear their seatbelt when riding in emergency vehicles. Firefighters have been and will be injured and killed because they were not wearing their seatbelt. This problem is not new. It persists today and will change in the future, not until we, the fire service, take responsibility to buckle up. We owe it to our families, each other, and ourselves. With this show, the National Seatbelt Pledge Campaign is being extended and expanded. The campaign program objective is by June 21, 2007, to have 1 million firefighters sign the pledge to wear their seatbelts. The impact objective is to reduce the number of firefighters killed because they did not have their seatbelt on by 100% in 2007. In other words, from now on, every firefighter, driver, company officer, and chief officer will wear their seatbelt. We will take responsibility for ourselves and each other. I'll be back in a moment with my panelists.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Leadership on the Line. Our first panel is made up of Captain Dwayne Hughes from the Columbus, Mississippi Fire Department. Dwayne had a significant emotional event related to seatbelts, and he's going to talk about seatbelts from the perspectives of the past, how things from the past can make changes today and then lead to changes in the future. So, Dwayne, welcome to Leadership on the Line. Why don't you tell our listeners about your seatbelt experience?
I'd be glad to. I really appreciate you having me show Dr. Clark. And I believe that initially my experience actually started with my first encounter with you. About 4 years ago, I was at the National Fire Academy, and we were getting acquainted. I believe you were making the rounds of your classes, and you stopped by in our class, and you began to talk about seatbelt safety. And I'm a little embarrassed right now, but at the time, I have to admit, I thought you were somewhat of a kook.
People still think that of me, Dwayne. That's okay.
I mean, of all the important issues that the fire service as a whole has to face, I really thought seatbelts use or misuse of them really wasn't a priority. I really didn't understand the main thrust of your message until I got back to my department. And as a custom, anytime we go off to any type of training, we'll get together with the shift and we'll describe our training and go over what we got out of it. And I began to talk about your speech that you gave about seatbelt safety and how I thought that I understood what you were trying to do, but I didn't really think it was important. And that really caught the attention of one of my battalion chiefs, one of our oldest, started to tell me that there was a lot in your seatbelt message that rang true with our department. In the hallway of our number one fire station, we have a gallery of photos that date back to the 1840s when our department was first formed. And amongst those pictures, there was a small, simple frame picture of a gentleman named Hugh Lee Newell. And under the bottom of the picture, it read, Hugh Lee Newell, September 11, 1931 to October 1st, 1972, our friend. I'd seen the photo many times, but I really didn't know the history behind it. And it was at that point that Battalion Chief Oswalt started to tell me the story about Hugh Lee Newell. His story, he was a driver in our department. And back in October of 1972, he and two other members of the department were responding to a fire call. And at that time, our department, the apparatus they ran were not enclosed. They were enclosed cabs. They also lacked seat belts. It was while they were making that fire run, that Hugh Lee Newell was the driver. He swerved to miss oncoming traffic and hit a curb. The firefighter who was standing on the tailboard was thrown over the truck and survived. The captain was able to maintain his seat, but the driver, Hugh Lee Newell, was thrown in front of the truck and run over and killed. And that his death, as tragic as it would have been under any other circumstances, was especially tragic in our department because 14 years prior, we lost a firefighter and a chief in an almost similar accident and almost similar incidents. And it was at that time that Battalion Chief Oswald told me that the department decided that they never wanted to again experience a death or what they viewed as a needless death because of apparatus they viewed as not being safe. So the first big major push within our department was to get enclosed cabs. That Hugh Lee passed in 1972, and by 1979, all the department's apparatus were of the enclosed cab variety. But that wasn't enough for the men of our department. They decided they wanted to go further and have seat belts installed on all the apparatus. And that's what really proved to be a major hurdle. The first hurdle they had to jump was they couldn't find anyone. No service departments, no companies that would install seat belts or what they considered retrofit installing seat belts on our apparatus. So the first seat belts that went on the trucks in our department were actually purchased by the men of the department, and they were installed by the men of our department. Our present chief, Kenneth Moore, who at that time was a training officer, personally installed the seat belts on our apparatus, of which we have two still operating today as reserve trucks. So it was a really big effort. The men of the department fought hard. They got enclosed cabs, they got seat belts, and I believe all the seat belts were installed by 1985. I joined the scene.
That's a heck of a story, and you could probably repeat that story in most every fire department in the country that went through that. And so that's why I wanted you to tell that story in terms of what our past was like. And now if you want to continue in terms of how you got involved with this and what your big change was.
I certainly will. I joined the department in 1995, and at that time seatbelt use was almost non-existent. As I said, a couple of those apparatus that the men of the department put this installed seatbelts on were still in use. And because they were retrofit, they interfered sometimes with the wearing of SCBA. So the common atmosphere around the department was if you had time, put them on, but most of the time, don't worry with them. And that was a far cry from the efforts that the guys of the department had tried so hard to get those seat belts installed. And myself, I was guilty of it. The newer guys, we very rarely, if any, wore the seat belts. And after hearing the story of Hugh Lee Newell, I began to tell some of the guys about it. And it actually started to affect them, to understand that it had been a struggle and a privilege to get those seat belts installed on the truck. And here it was 10 years later, we weren't even using them. But there were certainly some of the younger guys I just couldn't reach. They really didn't relate to Hugh Lee Newell. A lot of those guys weren't even born in 1972, so they just couldn't relate to him. It wasn't until one day we were doing station cleanup. We had a lady pulled up in front of the station with a small child, and she said she liked to look at the trucks and view the station. So just like any department, we saw this as an opportunity to get out of doing a little work. We said, sure, we'll give you a tour. We entered the station, and the lady pointed to the picture on the wall of Hugh Lee Newell, and she asked one of the younger firefighters, do you know who that guy is? And he responded. He said, yes, ma'am, that's Hugh Lee Newell. One of the members of our department was killed in line of duty. And that lady looked at him with tears in her eyes, and she said, yes, Hugh Lee was my father. And that lady's name was Miss Dina Vernon. She went on to tell how really touched she was that after all these years, the members of the department still remembered her father. And she began to tell the tale of how hard the department had fought to get seat belts installed on the trucks and how glad she was that we had the opportunity. and the blessing to be using them today. And I watched that young firefighter's face just fall, because he was one of the individuals that I'd had problem convincing to wear a seatbelt. Once Miss Vernon told her tale and she put it in terms he could understand, he came to me later and told me he really felt ashamed to stand in front of her, knowing that he didn't wear his seatbelt. And from that point forward, all you had to mention was Hugh Lee Newell's name, and seatbelts were buckled. Seatbelts that probably hadn't seen the light of day in years were dusted off, pulled out from under seats, and were being put into use. And so Miss Vernon really accomplished in just her simple visit what I had been trying to accomplish over many years. Just by putting a human face on that seatbelt issue, I can proudly say now that there's almost 90% of our department wears seatbelts, has actually signed a seatbelt pledge, and is committed to their use on each and every call. I've even seen instances where we've pulled trucks out onto the pad in front of the stations, and I've seen guys actually buckling up.
That's a wonderful story, Dwayne. I mean, I wish that could be repeated in all 32,000 fire departments, because it's not just somebody we don't know. It happens to our brothers and sisters, and we do have some responsibility for it, and we need to honor all those that go before us. And do what we know is right. So that's a great story and a great tribute to you. And tell the story about the officer that refused to move the fire truck, or the driver, rather, that refused to move the fire truck.
Oh, that's a very popular story in my department. It wasn't long after Miss Vernon's visit to our station, we had a driver, Mike Chandler, who had really been affected by the seatbelt story. And Hugh Lee's passing really affected him. He was one of the ones originally that really didn't see the use of seat belts. And with myself, Dr. Clark, he became a convert. He began to jokingly ask everyone as they got on the truck, "Is your Burt Clarked?" Which was his expression for, you know, that you have a seat belt on. Well, it happened to be one day when we got a tone on the truck, and we were getting ready to go out, and we had a captain who sat in the captain's position and didn't buckle up. Well, the driver, Mike Chandler, never moved the truck. After a minute, the captain looks over and said, "What's the problem?" And Chandler responded. He said, "Captain, until you buckle your seatbelt, this apparatus is not going to move." And from what I've heard, the captain got a little excited. But he ended up buckling that seatbelt. That apparatus did not move until his seatbelt was buckled. Mm. And afterwards, that captain came and actually apologized to that driver, which was a really big deal in our department, because we expected that he would be written up. But that captain apologized and told him from now on out, he was going to make sure that not only his seatbelt, that everyone else on that apparatus seatbelt was buckled before that truck moved.
Wow. Dwayne, that's an inspirational story that clearly illustrates how one person can make a significant change, not only in his own behavior, but those of his colleagues on his fire truck, and how that permeates throughout the department from stories being told and repeated. And I just got to congratulate you on your efforts and the whole department's efforts for getting so many people to buckle up. So that's great. We sure do appreciate you participating in today's show, and we'll be back in a moment.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Leadership on the Line. This is our second panelist dealing with seatbelts, and they're going to talk about the present condition related to seatbelts. In other words, what are we doing right now? The group this time is Lieutenant Mike Wilbur with the New York City Fire Department. Mike is also a national expert on vehicle safety. We also have Captain Henry Costa, who's the safety officer with the Philadelphia Fire Department, and Philly's been going through some seatbelt challenges over the past couple of years. And finally, our technical expert is Virginia Lutz. Virginia is an investigator for the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health. in the Firefighter Fatality Investigation and Prevention Program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this portion of the show. I think I'll start with Mike. If I may, Mike, and put you on the spot a little bit, what percentage of FDNY firefighters wear their seatbelt? Got a guess?
Probably on a good day, maybe 1%. Certainly nothing to be proud of.
You know, the reason I ask that, Mike, is because the rest of the fire service in America looks to New York in terms of their leadership. It's kind of, you know, follow the biggest kid on the block, if you will. And that's a challenge. You know, how do we change that for at least in terms of size, the leader of the American fire service?
A couple of things are in the works now. One of the revelations that we came across earlier in this year is that seatbelts and fire apparatus are not user-friendly at all, and almost to the point where they don't tend to work very well. And myself and a couple other people through the International Association of Fire Chiefs, Gordon Routley, who heads the safety and survival section, and Roger LaCour, a representative from Pierce Manufacturing and Engineer, who also is tied in with the NFPA Standards Committee 1901 on Motorized Fire Apparatus and FAMA, the Fire Apparatus Manufacturers Association. And we've kind of put together an ad hoc committee of three to try and improve the design of seatbelts. And it's a project that's really taken on a life of its own. One, to the point where we've started to measure firefighters in an anthropometric study and found out that the current cab configurations and the sizing of seats and so forth are just out of date and not correct, particularly with the advent of completely bunkering people up and filling pockets with spanner wrenches and screwdrivers and putting on radio pockets and flashlight pockets and now personal escape ropes, and we find out that we've added 25% to 35% of a firefighter's girth just in gear. And what we also found out is that the that fire apparatus manufacturers make good trucks, and that the seat manufacturers make good seats, and that seatbelt manufacturers make good seatbelts. But when we construct the vehicles, nobody really talked to one another with any kind of idea of meshing it all together in a safety package. And so to this end, we started the study and found out that things are not as good as they could be, and we've kind of started to partner up with NIOSH, and Virginia can certainly add to this as far as embarking on doing some body scans of firefighters, which could potentially impact everything from where grab rails are located on the fire apparatus to steps to the size or space between rungs of aerial ladders to gear to just a whole other bunch of issues that could be made safer and better. But our focus for right now is certainly on the seatbelt package and the seat package. And one of the moves afoot nationally, because of fire departments like Phoenix and LA City, there was a move afoot through the NFPA process to have a potential to take breathing apparatus out of the cabs altogether. And I think that's another reason why this issue has gotten attention. So when it comes to the seats and the seat belts, it's not as good as it could be, but there are folks out there working diligently right now to make improvements.
Mike, let me put you on the spot one more time. You're still a company officer on a ladder truck, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Do your guys wear their seat belts?
Well, that's how all this got started, quite frankly. I always have worn my seat belt and tried to lead by example, and actually have had several of my chauffeurs actually follow that example. But one of the problems I had were people riding in the back. And this whole issue really surfaced when I asked my people, well, why don't you wear seat belts? And it didn't become a factor of, Lou, we won't, or Lieutenant, we're not going to do that, but rather, Lou, they don't work. We can't do it. And so I said, well, you put your bunker gear on, and I'll grab my digital camera, and you show me why it doesn't work. And I started snapping some photographs, and it became painfully obvious that it just doesn't work.
Wow. I mean, I'm really going to push you now. Why do they have to put their bunker gear on going down the street? Why don't they just get bunkered out one day once they get there?
Well, that's another thing, and that brings up an interesting point. That's another discussion that we've had within the seatbelt meetings. Nobody really has come out nationally and said what the proper order of doing things particularly are. I know that with my people, they get bunkered up, with the exception of their helmets, go in and put their SCBA on, and then for the few that do would then put their seatbelts on. But there was a lot of discussion between some pretty knowledgeable fire department fire service leaders, and really nobody had even addressed what is the proper way to respond, and what order do we get. There were some manufacturers that thought that the SCBA were in the truck just to hold them, the brackets to hold the SCBA in place until the firefighters arrived on the scene, and then they would actually put the straps on. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, and I know the again, that part of the culture of the fire service where if you're riding in the apparatus and you get an indication of a working fire, that's akin to taking a kid into a candy store and telling them not to touch the candy. I mean, the people are going to put their breathing apparatus on and get strapped up.
I understand completely, Mike, but I see them not wearing, not just New York, but other places, I see them driving back from the call with no gear on, down by their feet, and they still don't have their seatbelt on, and they're coming back from the call.
Right, so exactly, and there's just no excuse for that, and I wouldn't even propose to make any.
All right. Let's move on to Philadelphia. Captain Costa, how are you doing today, sir?
Excellent, Bert.
I know that Philly has had a couple of life-changing injury with some of their firefighters. Would you share some of those if you can, and then how those experiences have impacted your organization?
Well, actually, I'd like to start off by saying that for me, once these experiences kind of highlighted something that has been entrenched, an attitude and a rationale that has allowed us to convince ourselves that it's okay not to wear seatbelts. And I had to reconcile myself to the fact that that is not an attitude that I'll be able to change overnight. It didn't develop overnight, and I won't be able to make it go away overnight. If I didn't reconcile myself to that fact, I was setting myself up for a mountain of frustration. Having said that, the case studies, if you will, to which you've referred, have highlighted dramatically, actually, a stark contrast, the results of having a seatbelt on while involved in a vehicular accident as opposed to not having one. One of the instances was one of our airport crash trucks had inadvertently ended up on an interstate highway, not a position in which they should have been and not one with which they were familiar. They were struck by a tractor trailer, and in the during the course of that accident, the driver, who did have his seatbelt on, remained in place and sustained no injuries whatsoever. However, the passenger riding in what would be the officer's seat was ejected from the vehicle through the windshield and sustained what ended up being very catastrophic injuries, career-ending injuries. In terms of the human cost, I can't even put a price tag on it. But in dollar costs, we're well up over $1 million in terms of the amount of money that has been spent in medical care and rehabilitation efforts on this firefighter. Unfortunately, one who will never return to the job. We had another recent incident in which a medic unit driving in very inclement weather. It was snowing on the ground, and a vehicle heading in the opposite direction to our medic unit left the highway, crossed the median strip, and landed square in front of our apparatus. It resulted in a fatality for that driver, and our paramedics were uninjured, very minor injuries. And it was actually ironic because the driver had been involved in an accident only a couple of weeks prior to this particular incident, and he had not had his seatbelt on and had been banged up a little bit. When he got into the medic unit that particular day, especially because of the snow, he buckled up and said to his partner, "You know, I'd really appreciate it if you put your belt on because I just had this accident," and et cetera, et cetera. So, ironically, they were wearing the belts, and they sustained absolutely no injuries whatsoever, despite the fact that, obviously, if you had a fatality, it was a pretty severe impact.
Well, I also happen to know that particular incident, I think anyway, that the first arriving fire apparatus, the officer was one of those paramedics' dads.
That's correct. Yes, it is.
You know, and do you happen to know if that company has started wearing their seatbelts?
Actually, I don't know that, and I do know that I can agree with Mike that let's say it's not an epidemic. The people that wear seatbelts in our department, I think 1%.
If you could put a percentage on that, what would it be?
I think 1%. I might be a little overly optimistic.
You know, even in today, guys, I hate to tell you, but I find that incredible. You know, should we be concerned about that? Should we be outraged about that? What should our reaction to those numbers be?
Are you asking?
Yeah, Henry. Yeah, I'd ask you, Henry.
Okay.
I mean,
Well, I think there's a multitude of reactions. One of them, certainly, we should be angry. Certainly, we should be frustrated. But I have to think that, in line with some things Mike was alluding to earlier, we are a victim of our own culture, our own approach to the go-get-it attitude. I think also we send our firefighters mixed signals. Mike had alluded to the fact that some manufacturers are under the impression that including the SCBA and positioning them within the apparatus in the seat backs, which is what virtually all apparatus in Philadelphia, that's a configuration that we have. They think that we're going to put them on when we arrive at the scene, and that's just not the case. And we may be sending our people mixed signals when we put the SCBA into a seat back, incorporate it in that manner, and even if it's a subconscious signal that says, okay, don your seatbelts. Dr. Clark, you're familiar with an incident in Philadelphia where one of our rescue people was standing up in the rescue vehicle while it was responding, donning his SCBA. Mm-hmm. The irony there is that while he's donning a piece of protective equipment that is designed to protect and ensure his safety, is performing a very unsafe act.
Mm-hmm.
And when the vehicle lurched, he toppled over, struck his ribs against one of the protruding pieces of the apparatus, and actually was off for quite a significant amount of time. I mean,
and the company never made it to the call.
No, they didn't. So that's ironic to me, but again, I will say that these attitudes are entrenched, and I think that we can't throw our hands up in frustration, but I really believe we have to recognize that it is going to take us a while to persuade people that they need to wear seatbelts or dissuade them from an attitude that allows them to think it's okay to not wear seatbelts.
Well, thanks. All right, let's move to the NIOSH folks. Now that some of our biggest fire departments have admitted that they're not meeting their own SOPs, NIOSH comes in. Virginia, Ms. Lutz, you're an investigator, and you have to go out and look at the aftermath of these kind of things. Would you just give us a little overview of how NIOSH is involved with firefighter safety and what the goals of the NIOSH Firefighter Fatality Investigation and Prevention Program are?
Okay, thank you, Dr. Clark. It's really an honor to be able to speak to the group and to get this message out to the fire service. A little bit of background about NIOSH and the Firefighter Fatality Program. We are a federal agency, and NIOSH has been in existence since 1970 and what came about during the Occupational Safety and Health Act. However, in 1998, it was decided that we needed an independent agency to look strictly at firefighter line of duty deaths, and that out of that was born the Firefighter Fatality Investigation and Prevention Program. We do heart attack and cardiovascular, and there's a group of us who do nothing but trauma investigations. We, after our investigations, we do prepare a report, and that report is then placed on our website for departments to use for training purposes and to get information out. We are non-regulatory. We are not OSHA. We strictly do an investigation to create a lessons learned type of document and work with the fire service.
All right, and we're going to have a link to that website right at the bottom of this page. In the meantime, how many line of duty deaths has NIOSH investigated where seatbelts were a possible contributing factor?
Okay, actually I did a little research on this, so bear with me and I'll outline this for the group. We have done, since our we came into existence at the end of 1998, we have done a total of 358 line-of-duty death investigations. About one half of those were trauma, and about one third of those were motor vehicle related. Out of the motor vehicle related, about 60% of the motor vehicle related investigations and line-of-duty deaths involved seat belts as a possible factor. The other 40% were mainly struck by incidents. We've had we've done five where there were POVs responding or returning from the scene. We've had eight fall from vehicles. I have done four fall from vehicles myself in the past 3 years. The most common factor there was mentioned already in this discussion, which was donning of gear. While the vehicle is moving or reaching for gear, or some reason may have had a seatbelt on but released it to get a hold of part of the gear or reach for something. We've had six ejected, and the largest percentage has been involved with tankers, the largest percentage of our line of duty investigations. And we've actually had 13 volunteer firefighters killed in tanker rollovers.
It's a shame. Could you give us a little overview of some of the line of duty death investigation recommendations that NIOSH has made?
Well, in addition to just simply not wearing a seatbelt, we have found that, for instance, there are no seatbelts in the vehicle. Possibly it was an older unit or used only as a reserve. The main apparatus is a surplus military vehicle and possibly arrived in less than optimum condition to begin with, and no funds or little funds to repair properly. There was a seat belt there, but it was not in working order. It was buried under the seat cushion and, you know, somewhere that it was, you could tell it was not being worn for a good long time. Apparatus inspections, there's a long time between the service or maintenance appointments. And a contributory factor we found is that in some states there's no inspection requirement for fire apparatus. We've had the apparatus inspections, but they don't look at seat belts. We've had issues where there was a broken seat belt reported, but it was considered a low priority issue. We've had defective apparatus that was identified, but they could not remove it from service because they had no spare apparatus to use. But in all honesty, it's the apparatus. Too often we find the apparatus has working seat belts. The department has SOPs for seat belt usage. They make it a training item, but it's just not enforced. And as an investigator, it's mind-boggling to me. As a mom, it makes me angry. I just wish every firefighter could go along with us investigators. We fire departments see possibly one or associated with one or know of one fatality where this has possibly been a factor in their careers. We see this over and over, and it is, like I said, every line of duty death is heartbreaking, every single one, but something where, in all essence, it is preventable, it's avoidable, that makes me angry. And I think it does all of us are on this call today. And I know Mike Wilbur brought up the anthropometric study that NIOSH is participating in, and those meetings have just begun, because I do hear from the firefighters, and I do understand and am sympathetic to the seatbelt issues and the size issues and the problems. This body scan study that NIOSH is hoping to has not received funding or is not finalized as yet, but the goals of this study are to look at seat comfort and seatbelt design and things like driver visibility, stepping heights, ladder design, standing control heights, hose packing ergonomics, everything associated safety-wise that we can look at in an engineering fashion for the comfort and safety of the firefighters and those aboard the apparatus. So there is, it is encouraging, and it is just one other stone that we don't want to leave unturned. So hopefully there'll be some good successes come out of that.
I appreciate that feedback. Just to share with you, I had the opportunity to talk to an officer who lost his firefighter because lack of seat belts, and this particular officer was not a seatbelt user, and so you can imagine the trauma he is going through. And in talking to him, one of the statements he made to me was pretty eye-opening to me. He said, "Bert, it was selfish of me not to wear my seatbelt," and that he didn't realize that until he had experienced the loss. And if all of us have to experience loss before we change our behavior, I pray that that's not our best teacher. So we can learn through programs like this and what NIOSH is doing and the efforts. Even Mike taking pictures and showing what works and doesn't work. I mean, that's great. I think it was the Atlantic City Fire Department. They went out and got extenders for some of their larger firefighters that just like they do on an airplane. The extender goes in and the person can get it around. And the extender is left right up there for those that are a little larger than the rest of us. So, boy, any firefighter that can't figure out how to get their seatbelt on, I don't know if I want them backing me up. So that's a real challenge. Let me go back to the big guys in terms of the metro departments. Guys, what's your chief of department? What's your department doing to try to get this 1% higher? For example, I think it's Chicago. Every time the apparatus goes on the air, they remind them that they're supposed to wear their seatbelt. Is New York doing anything specifically, Mike, to try to encourage people to put their seatbelt on?
There's an educational program right now. There has been some infighting between the union and management. We've had two firefighters fall out of rigs since last December for a variety of reasons. One was stated was allegedly a faulty latch. I'm not sure whether that's proved out or not, but the reality is, and the chief of department stand is that had everybody been buckled in, it didn't even need to have a door or not. The reality is that if they had seatbelts on, they wouldn't have fallen off the trucks. There have been educational changes, and I agree with my counterpart from Philadelphia that this problem didn't occur overnight, and the solution certainly isn't going to occur overnight as well. I think we've made some pretty good strides as far as safety. I mean, I'm here in Montgomery County, Maryland right now, which was really had one of the worst driving records in the country, and because of their leadership and because of their willingness to change, have turned it around, and they've created a 48% reduction in accidents with apparatus in just a year's time. And they have a mandatory seatbelt policy that's strictly enforced. And we have 100 people gathered here this week and this two-day summit symposium, which is called Arrive Alive. And to have a focus group of 100 firefighters gathered to talk about driving safety and seatbelt use and firefighter safety in and around the vehicles is would have been unthought of just 15 short years ago. So I think radio shows like this and your determination through your Seatbelt Pledge program and the work that I do and others, I think we're making an impact. It's just we've come a long way, but we just have a long way to go.
And I ask you to get 100 more signatures on a Seatbelt Pledge before the weekend's over, Mike.
Okay, we can do that. Absolutely.
If you can't get all 100 of those, we should all hang up our boots.
Amen to that. Absolutely.
Captain Costa, what's Philly doing at the organizational level?
If I might add to what Mike was speaking to, and also actually Virginia touched on something that's sort of near and dear to my heart earlier. Of course, once you prescribe mandatory utilization of seatbelts, of course enforcement is a necessary element of that program and that policy. However, I think we may be missing the boat at times, because at the end of the day, if the only compliance is due to enforced compliance, pretty much all you're guaranteeing that the seatbelts will be worn whenever people are being watched. And unless we can all create special safety police units that run around and follow our rigs and ensure that our members are wearing the seatbelts when the vehicle's in motion, we're pretty much guaranteeing only minimal compliance. And what our goal is, and it's taking time and it's baby steps, is to get beyond minimal compliance to what I like to call enlightened compliance. And what we're trying to do is to make the case for wearing seatbelts so compelling, so apparent, so convincing, to make that message so pervasive and persistent throughout all of the training initiatives that we conduct, that the need now to wear the seatbelts is recognized, that it becomes internalized by our members. Now, that's something that's going to happen overnight, because it is a huge shift in paradigm and in approaches to firefighter and approaches to what they do when they get onto an embarker rig. Having said that, a lot of the things that we do, it has got to the point where it's just an element of our training that's pounded away in order to establish that degree of pervasiveness and persistence. It's pounded away from the very first exposure of our cadets in the academy to their very first driving experience in the emergency vehicle operators course. It's an element, and it's reinforced the message throughout all of our continuing on-campus training, whether it's the driver qualification and testing process, whether it's the continuing education and remedial training that we do, even in the officer development program that's provided to all our newly promoted officers. It's a theme that is reinforced and reemphasized over and over and over again. We've even gone so far to, I don't know if this is novel for all departments, but it's certainly novel for us, members who have been involved in vehicular accidents who have been injured while not wearing seatbelts, or members who have escaped injuries, near misses, so to speak, because they were wearing seatbelts. They've been invited to share their experiences during one of the training initiatives, or more, that I alluded to earlier. So we would bring them up and have them speak to the audience, whichever training folk group was involved, and they would actually share their experience in terms of the human cost. So what I think that does is it puts a face to the message and really identifies the human cost. Again, it's intangible, the effect that it's having, and as yet, I'm not seeing the numbers on there. I think there's some things that need to be done in terms of the study that Virginia is conducting and things Mike is doing in terms of changing the configuration of the seats and the seat belts, but that's not something that I can own right now, the engineering aspect. So what we can own is the enforcement slash compliance aspect and the training slash education aspect, and that's been the focus. Even a stand-down participation, Mike, I'm sure you're familiar with the national stand-down that has been conducted the last 2 years. Even during that stand-down, the focus has been driver safety, particular emphasis being placed on the wearing of seatbelts. There's certainly been a lot of effort by the fire department, and our department, our commissioners committed to it. When I'll start to see results, I really can't predict, but I'd like to say that it's going to be sooner than later.
Yeah, I think one thing with that is that we have done a really good job in the past decade or so of training people. We have done a really good job of accounting for people vis-a-vis RIT teams and FAST teams, but we have done a tremendously lousy job of instilling in firefighters their own personal accountability for their own safety. That you nobody should have to reach around and tell anybody to put a seatbelt on. We're all big boys and girls in fire departments throughout the country, and that's something that needs to be done. And we're even getting some really unwanted help in the form of a firefighter in California right now that's facing criminal charges because he did not have one of his crew members on board seatbelted in. And as we know, the NFPA says that the driver is going to be held accountable and that he cannot move the rig unless the firefighter is rest seated and belted in an enclosed position, and he can't engage the vehicle in any gear. And along with the California vehicle and traffic statute about everybody being belted in, this is one of three serious charges that this firefighter is now facing because of that firefighter fatality in California. And he's one of three drivers this month alone that have been indicted in criminal actions against fire department operators.
You know,
I was just going to say, it's sad to say that maybe that's what it's going to take, some external force to change our culture if we are so reluctant to do it.
Well, I think one thing, too, that I keep hearing when I'm out there, that seatbelt usage is a matter of personal preference. And it's you know, I'm in control of my destiny. It's just me. But I think what the message that doesn't get across a lot of times is during these accidents, possibly had the driver had their seatbelt on, they would have maintained better control of the apparatus when there was a dangerous situation. Possibly it would have never gone off the road at all, or they'd have been able to correct had they been able to, you know, sit more securely in the seat. So I don't think that message gets out a lot as well, that yes, seatbelt, it will save your life, but it will also help you save the lives of those others, you know, in the apparatus and on the highway. So.
Well, thank you. On that note, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a moment.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Leadership on the Line. The topic today is seatbelts, and our last panel is going to talk about the future in seatbelts. To talk about that is Chief Al Wu of the Washington Township Fire Department. Al was really the beginning of at least my quest about trying to get people to wear their seatbelts, so he's been involved with this all along, and we'll hear from him in a minute. Another person that's been very closely involved with this is Carolyn Smith-Clark. She's an adjunct faculty member at the National Fire Academy and instructor for the Maryland Fire Rescue Institute. And Carolyn has seen me go through this seatbelt saga up close and personal because she happens to be my wonderful wife, and we're going to hear from her because she's taught in all 50 states, and she's tried to get lots of people to sign a seatbelt pledge. And finally, the last person to join us is Mr. Jim Juneau, and Jim is the legal counsel for the Fire Apparatus Manufacturers Association. Jim also serves on an NFPA Technical Committee for Fire Apparatus 1901. So, folks, thank you very much for joining. What I'd like you to talk about now is this whole concept of seatbelts in the future, but from the perspectives of, like, the individual, and then the organization, and finally the industry. So, Carolyn, if I can start with you, because you've tried to get lots of people to sign that seatbelt pledge and put their seatbelt on. So what do you see as some of our future challenges, and what do we have to do to get people to sign that pledge and make the commitment and buckle up?
Well, I'm really proud to be part of the show today. I've experienced over the last several years since you've been trying to enforce or get people to change their attitude towards seatbelts and have it become part of their just natural behavior. With the students, I see hundreds of students every year. And when we talk about the seatbelt pledge, it always surprises me that in this day and age, some of the comments that comes back. And that personal attitude, it was mentioned earlier on the show about how individuals taking their own accountability. I get all types of feedback from individuals saying that I'm just worried about I have to take care of myself. I'm not responsible for anyone else. And in fact, our discipline is responsible for each other. That's what the makeup of our discipline happens to be. And so we should be held accountable for others that might be sitting next to us without their seatbelt on to remind them that it's the right thing to do. It was very interesting to me. I'm down here in Florida, so sorry about the background noise. Clear out here in the parking lot. I tried to get a few departments in the area here to allow me to come in to do this radio program, and some of the comments that I received back was that their department was far from 100% of people wearing their seatbelts, so they felt very uncomfortable, I guess maybe admitting it or having their names mentioned in this program. And talking to the individuals, they all said the same as my students have said over and over again, that yes, that's probably the right thing to do, but you know, if nothing's going to happen to us, we're kind of invincible. That's the nature of our job, is to be put at risk. And I try to communicate back, especially signing the seatbelt pledge, is that you are committing to others and your family. The most important piece of it is that your safety, that you should be proud to be able to stand up and say that I'm taking my own accountability, my own safety into my own hands, and that I want to return back safe.
Well, Kellen, thank you very much for that. Chief Wu, if we can move to you. Your organization has probably been working on this issue diligently for the longest period of time, because it really was you and I started this whole process together. So since 2002, and you've seen all aspects of it, from getting my first email to hiring a battalion chief and having a question about seatbelts as an exercise. So give us an update where you are and where you think the organizations have to get to so that they can have seatbelt compliance.
Well, I'd say that we're farther ahead than most, I guess, and maybe because we've been working on it again, as you remind me painfully, the longest. But I will say that I see that as a bigger awareness, at least across the state of Ohio, and I'll give you a perfect example. While we utilize that question initially in an assessment for our captains or battalion chiefs immediately after that incident, I'm involved with assessing departments across the state. That has become a sample question for fire officers across the state, at least the organization, the Ohio Fire Chiefs, when we do assessments, and that's a situation. And selection is based, or partly based, on how well the candidate answers that question. So it's become statewide. And so in that aspect, the awareness of it has really increased, and people always give me a shot to the ribs with an elbow, hey, this is yours, or whatever. And it really isn't. I mean, the chiefs in that area, those departments, select that question. So I'm pretty pleased with that. As far as your compliance with our department, I have to say we're far, far ahead. Do I have the occasional person going to sneak? Absolutely. But I just was driving into the office, passing a rig, returning from a call, or returning actually from training, and I could see the seatbelts all across the guy's chest in the cab. So I'm pretty happy with regards to that. It's still frustrating when I hear others. And in fact, I think 2005, when we did FDIC, within 30 days after we left Indianapolis, there had been a report, and I believe it came out of Texas, of a guy who rolled out of a truck, was run over and killed.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's the highs and the lows, but I think all in all, I'm satisfied at least where we're going as a department and where the state's starting ahead.
Yeah. Talk for a minute about, because we've heard Mike and some other departments talk about this whole engineering aspect as an issue, and I know you had to address this. Can you talk about that for a few minutes and how you all solved it?
We had some issues with that. Again, same problems. Hey, the seatbelts weren't long enough. We had actually one of the manufacturers that we had, the seatbelt company that they had used had gone out of business. So they couldn't get those seatbelts anymore, and because the seats were tested as an integrated system, it became difficult. You know, we looked at it and said, listen, who's got the bigger liability? If I get somebody killed who rolls out of a truck, or because we used a different seatbelt and may contribute slightly to a different injury. And we looked at the lesser of the two evils, you know, and we'll put the mismatched seatbelt in. I didn't really care at that point in time. It was just, let's get it done. One of the other issues is, and there was that I had a guy who initially was, you know, you got to be kidding me. You're going to enforce a seatbelt policy, who prided himself in being able to get in one of the rigs. And he's a fairly large guy, and showed me, proved to me that he could get his SCB on, be bunked up, and still maintain or wear his seatbelt while he was doing it. And again, that was a positive for me. Hey, it was an awareness thing. They were able to do it. And so we addressed a lot of those issues. And it was, one of the manufacturers, hey, there's a liability issue. Well, there's a liability issue if I don't. We'll never get away from the liability issues. So I'd much rather they have them on than they not.
Very good. And Jim, let's move to you if we can, because you're kind of the industry guy here. You look at it from lots of different levels, from both the standards in terms of NFPA and the engineering in terms of manufacturing. So what do you see in the future for us? And is this issue going to be solved solely by standards and engineering?
Well, certainly not. And I think that everyone agrees that the seatbelt issue is primarily it begins as a training issue, but then it becomes an issue of experienced firefighters taking well-trained recruits and over time teaching them, passing on to them dangerous traditional practices that exist in the fire service. And certainly, you know, riding to the fire without your seatbelt on is one of those. There are many others. But, Carolyn was talking about speaking to students, and they talk about accountability and how they only feel accountable for themselves and not for the others on the rig. And, you know, when you look at testing video or you look at real video that shows what happens in a rollover, mm-hmm. the responsible belted occupant's worst enemy is the unbelted occupant that's across the cab from them. Because when the truck rolls over, and that's how people die in fire apparatus, you know, in automobiles, we look at restraint systems trying to address the most serious kind of accident that you get in a passenger vehicle, and that's head-on collisions. But in fire trucks, if you look at the accidents that kill firefighters, and we lose 30 firefighters a year going to and coming from the fire, the type of accidents that kills firefighters is rollovers. Typically rollovers accompanied by ejections, but not always. And in a rollover accident, the belted firefighter's worst enemy is his unbelted companion across the cab from him, because he's coming across that cab at a fairly high speed with 250 pounds of mass, slamming into the belted firefighter, and that's a serious injury-causing event. Mm-hmm. Carolyn mentioned that firefighters believe that we're invincible and the nature of our job is to put ourselves at risk. And that's really not the nature of your job. The nature of your job is to provide a public service when you get to the scene, and you only get to do that if you can arrive at the scene alive and capable of performing the duties that you've sworn to perform. And, you know, all the air packs and gloves and pass devices and helmets and turnout gear, none of that stuff is going to help you between the firehouse and the scene. The one piece of protective gear that is most likely to save your life in those circumstances is the seatbelt. You know, the engineering issues have come up and been discussed among the manufacturers. I know that right now there is a study going on, a human factors type of study, to analyze what size the typical firefighter might be. You know, human factors is the science of knowing how wide is a wide receiver, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's research going on to look at the average size of firefighters, including the kind of gear that a typical firefighter would be wearing on the apparatus, and making sure that the seat belts are positioned such and have enough webbing such that the firefighter can easily put the seat belt on over his gear. I think with some of the new changes that are coming about, you know, we're getting pre-tensioning seatbelt systems that automatically exert a retractive force on the occupant when the vehicle tips over. We're also getting side airbag and air curtain protection systems that protect the occupant's head in the event of a rollover. And I think as those systems go into place, the seatbelts will tend to become integrated into the seat as opposed to being bolted onto the chassis of the apparatus or onto the body of the apparatus. And that'll give us an opportunity to engineer the seat belts in a way that they're more comfortable
where the latch plate is more easily found and the buckle is more easily found. But you know, you talk to firefighters and you look at your own experience. I know when I get in my car, I don't need to see the latch plate and see the buckle to get my seatbelt fastened, because regular seatbelt users develop kind of a muscle memory. You reach up, you know where the latch plate is in your car, and you swing it across your lap, and I would bet 9 times out of 10 you can hit that buckle without looking, because you do it every time you get in the car. And when you ask firefighters to raise their hands how many people occasionally at least don't wear their seatbelt in the fire apparatus, you'll get a few hands in every crowd. And you ask those people to keep their hands up if they regularly don't wear a seatbelt in their passenger vehicle, and all the hands go down.
All right.
Because this feeling of invincibility, the big red truck syndrome, I'm in a big vehicle, I'm high up, I'm really not touchable by those little cars down there on the road. And of course, history and the statistics show us that's just not true. Maybe it's a different kind of accident that's going to get you, but accidents with fatalities in fire apparatus happen all the time, and there is truly a risk to those guys, and they need to realize that, and that's a training issue.
Cal, if I can come back to you for a minute, because part of your background, you're a grief counselor, and you can't speak to this from experience, but at least from a theoretical standpoint, what do the survivors of an accident where somebody dies because they don't have their seatbelt on? I mean, it's whether you're the driver or the officer or the people on the crew or the person's parents or wife or mother, I mean, that's got to be one of the most devastating things to go through. Can you speak to that for a minute?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Some of the questions that go through their mind is thinking about the simple act of just the seatbelt possibly could have saved their life, or even feeling guilty, especially other crew members when they've lost somebody from the department, feeling that guilt that they carry around with them for a while. But surprisingly enough, that after that passes doesn't necessarily mean that they change their behavior, that they automatically start wearing a seatbelt. They might temporarily for a while, but then they feel that sense of, they're not talking about me, that's not going to happen to me. That attitude sets back in again. But the families, even the grief the family goes through by even losing somebody, a loved one that's never going to be with them any longer, still, just the simple thing of knowing that they want to put blame, that's part of the grief process, so they want to put blame back on the fire department. They want to put blame on people that were with them, that didn't remind them to put it on. But the bottom line of it is, and I try to communicate that with the people that I'm in touch with on a continual basis, the students, that we are accountable for our own actions and our own responsibility. And even that action of wearing a seatbelt and returning back safe, you can't just think of yourself. You have to think beyond that. And beyond that are your family members at the fire department, your family members that are home. I mean, when something happens like that, and none of us think that we're going to be in a situation like that, but it can happen so quickly, and our lives change so drastically, and it's long-lasting just from a simple action of doing the right thing.
Well, thank you. Panelists, I just want to give you all one more opportunity to leave a final word of wisdom to our listeners today, so we'll start back at the beginning. Dwayne, any final closing comments?
No. Again, Dr. Clark, just wanted to say how much of an honor it was being included on this panel. Listening to all the comments from the different departments really opened my eyes today. Maybe it has to come down to an issue of enforcement to get people to buckle up. In my case, it was lessons learned from the past. Whatever it takes, I hope we all as a community decide that seatbelt usage is now.
Thank you. Mike Wilbur, what's your closing comments for us?
Well, having just gone through 2 line-of-duty deaths and then having visited the National Fallen Firefighters weekend 2 weekends ago, the tragedy is too great, the toll is too great, And we really need to move forward in many different directions to try and get people to buckle up. And I applaud you for your efforts trying to get the seatbelt pledge out there. And I pledge to you to do everything I can to help. And hopefully we can get those million firefighters to sign up by the middle of next year.
Well, that's great. Thanks, Mike. Virginia, Ms. Lutz, closing comments?
Yes. Again, thank you. It's gratifying to be on the to be able to use our reports for preventative information, and it's in commenting on something that Carolyn said. It's one of the saddest things that I heard in one of my investigations was a story of a little 4-year-old, the child of one of the victims, and just said, you know, why didn't Daddy have a seatbelt on? Why didn't he love me enough? So those are the things. I know I'm a professional investigator, but those are the things that you can't separate your heart out from these things. And if we could just take it just a moment, if every firefighter would just take a moment and think about that, I pledge to you as well, Dr. Clark, that in all of my visits I will certainly promote the pledge and the effort for zero fatalities from this from now forever. So
thank you. Thank you.
Welcome.
Captain Costa, what do you got to say from Philly?
Well, Dr. Clark, first I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to share in this experience. It's greatly appreciated. I certainly learned a lot from the panelists. I would like to say that I think we need to do a better job of establishing and exploiting these kinds of networks that are established within these type of venues, and do a better job maybe of sharing the lessons learned. Virginia touched on something that struck me earlier in the panel when she discussed some of the case studies and mentioned something that is something that I lament and yet applaud, and that is that we only do have one or two experiences in a career that highlight this, but we learn lessons at very dearly purchased lessons, very dearly mm-hmm. purchased high price. And I'd like to try to do is share some of the lessons learned from others and maybe get them at maybe quite nice. They're not quite so expensive. And
yeah.
I think that this is an opportunity, these kinds of venues. I'd like to talk with Mike and maybe get some contact information afterwards from Mike and Virginia. I was unaware of this symposium down in Montgomery County, and this is my bailiwick here. And maybe that's we need to do a better job of sharing information and lessons with each other.
Well, thank you very much, Henry. Chief Wu, you're next, but I want to thank you personally, Chief. I mean, you really did start all this. I can't imagine how it would have been different if, in terms of your response to my email I sent you the first time, because I can remember sending that, how nervous I was, tattletaling on my brothers for not wearing their seatbelt, and how I struggled with that in terms of, am I responsible for other firefighters when I get on a fire truck, even if I'm not in that fire department? And after that day, I made the decision, if I'm in your fire truck, we're all putting our seatbelt on, or we're not moving, because I'm going to kick and scream and holler and raise holy hell and tell everybody until people wear their seatbelt. So that's a tribute to you and your organization. So what words of wisdom do you have for the rest of us, Chief?
I appreciate it, Bert. You know what? It's really simple, and I think I've come to that this understanding after dealing with this for the last few years, or is that there's all kinds of excuses. It's really simple. We could probably affect 90% of the firefighters in this country today if, by being an officer, you just take responsibility for yourself and your people, you get in the truck and say, put on your seatbelt, and let's go. You know, and it's that simple. Hey, there is no tolerance. It's zero tolerance policy. Put on your damn seatbelt before we go to the call. Put on your seatbelt before we come back. I mean, we can all have all kinds of excuses, but it's really, truly that simple. And there may be the occasion where there'll be an issue where it's non-functioning or something, but it's that simple. Just do it. And I think we take care of a lot of those problems. And we can always address the technical issues later. But, you know, we can address the immediate issues now.
That's great. I appreciate that. And Carolyn Smith-Clark, I want to publicly thank you, too, because you certainly have held the mirror up to me in terms of my commitment and my belief, and you make sure that I follow through every day. So if I have any success, it's because you make me have success, and I want to thank you personally. I guess I can tell you I love you on the line, too. But with that's probably unfair. But what closing comments would you have for the folks out there about seatbelts?
Well, I was just going to share before I give my closing comments, my love for you and the commitment that you have to the fire service is just unbelievable, and I'm sure other people in the fire service realize that also. But the thoughts that go through your mind and the research that you put into it and time and effort in changing our behavior for something that's for the better. But I want to go back to what Chief Wu said in my closing comments. You know, we learn by example. Every behavior that any individual incorporates in their life is because of something that they have learned in someone in their environment. And I think it's just as simple as he said, let's just do it because it's the right thing to do. Don't accept people's behavior that's incorrect. And I think if we all continually talk about it and don't think about being the popular person in your fire department, you just do it because you know it's the right thing to do, because you care for those individuals and you have love for the people that you work with also. And again, thank you for letting me be part of this.
Glad you're here. And you're becoming home soon. I can't wait.
Yes.
And Jim, you get to have the final comment, Jim, representing the apparatus manufacturers and FPA, and also yourself, because I know you were a responder, and you get to go talk to these families after a tragedy also. So you've got a lot to share with us.
Please. Well, I tell you, you know, I know that the industry is committed to provide the kind of advanced technology and the kind of improvements to the equipment that's necessary to promote maximum safety and maximum reliability. I know that the NFPA Apparatus Committee looks at emerging technology. The composition of the committee with chief officers and also technical representatives from manufacturers and others who have special knowledge, it's a really good opportunity to evaluate new technology and decide what ought to be on the fire apparatus of the future. And I think there are going to be some changes, and I think they're good changes. However, you know, whatever change you make to the equipment is totally meaningless if you have a situation like Chief Wu described, where the individual firefighters don't take responsibility for themselves. You know, they don't make their partner put the seatbelt on. The operator of the fire truck doesn't ensure that everybody's buckled before he moves it. The officer doesn't authorize the vehicle to move without everyone being belted. And the command officers above those folks make it not just policy but culture within their fire department that everybody rides buckled up, and hopefully everybody arrives alive and in condition to perform the services they're committed to perform. And you know, that takes a personal commitment, and it takes a willingness to enforce what you know is the right thing. You know, it's I think Schwarzkopf said it's generally pretty easy to know what the right thing to do is. The tough part is doing it, and that's certainly true in the area of seat belts and fire apparatus, and I applaud your efforts in that regard. I know that that you've written and done a lot to promote seatbelt use, and I encourage you to keep it up. I pledge to do the same.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank the entire panel for participating in the discussion about seatbelts, past, present, and future. There are links to various web pages, including the National Seatbelt Pledge Campaign, NIOSH case studies, Fire Apparatus Manufacturers Association, and some of the latest articles that will be coming out in the Volunteer Firemen Insurance Services Organization. And just as a closing comment, the seatbelt pledge, we're trying to get 1 million firefighters to sign their name on the pledge to say, I'm going to wear my seatbelt. I don't think in the history of the fire service 1 million firefighters have come together and done one same thing together, because we have so many different levels of department, from the chief of New York City to the newest volunteer rookie. But every one of them can say, from today on, I'm going to wear my seatbelt. I'm going to take the pledge and wear it, because we owe it to each other. So hopefully the National Seatbelt Campaign will take off. It doesn't cost any money. All it takes is a little honor on everybody's part and the courage to sign it, because it is our duty. With that, this has been Leadership on the Line. I'm Dr. Burton Clark.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.